Motopod, proudly supported by Roadskin, a UK label specializing in protective outerwear for motorcyclists. Modern biker clothing that you can wear all day long and engineered to save your skin. For the road, for life, visit roadskin.co.uk. Hello and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 788 for October 30th, 2024. I'm Jim McDowell, across the pond in merry old England, fresh back from Germany, is the world traveler himself, Richard Jowett. Richard, glad you can make time for us, I guess. I should be happy.
Thank you, Jim. Yeah, guten Tag, or guten Nacht, I should say, in the present context.
Very true. Did you have a good time in Germany?
Fantastic time. Love Germany, as I was talking to you just before we came on air. Lived there for a year back in 2000, so it was a bit of a blast down memory lane for my wife and I to go back and reminisce a little bit around Hamburg, which is a beautiful city, wonderful people, great beer, lovely food. Even the weather was good to us. So yeah, five very pleasurable days, but always good to be back in England and equally even better to be talking about motorbike racing.
Yep. When with that, let's just get right to it. We were in Thailand for the GP this past race. It's the second of the triple headers. Malaysia is this coming weekend, a week off, and then we're finally to the last race of the year in Valencia.
Yeah.
So we'll kick it off first with just a little bit of news. There's only one thing that I was able to come up with news. Richard was right. I'd like to make sure that you all understand that he did tell us that Andrea Iannone would be in to replace DG Antonio at VR46 for Malaysia. He is. That's been confirmed. So props to you, sir.
No, you're giving me credit where it's not due, Jim. I was saying Nico Bulliger, wasn't I?
Bulliger.
From World Superbikes, whereas it's Andrea Iannone that's come in from World Superbikes. So
it's been a rough week for me, guys. I'm sorry.
I mean, Andrea Iannone is a, how should we put this politely? I mean, he's a somewhat divisive figure, isn't he, given his... Well, not necessarily recent past, but because, of course, he's just this year's back in international racing again, having served his four-year ban for the doping.
Banned substance.
Yeah.
I forgot about it. Okay. I got these mixed up.
He divides opinion, but he did win a World Superbike race this year in not the factory team, it's a well-supported Go 11 team, I think it was. So not what I was expecting. I thought Nico Bulliger was going to get the nod on that one. But Iannone makes sense. I mean, he's obviously got past MotoGP experience, albeit quite some time ago. And let's not forget, he got kind of booted out of Ducati because of taking Dovizioso out in Argentina, if I recall. I can't remember what year that was, but it's obviously, 6 years ago, I suppose. And then had that troubled season at Aprilia before the whole doping scandal hit. And then the rest of history is, we know. So, yeah, anyway, he's going to come in. Interestingly, though, Jim, only for Malaysia. So whether his participation in Valencia, because DiGi Antonio is obviously out for the rest of the season now, he's gone off to have his shoulder surgery. So whether that means that they might bring somebody else in for Valencia, and it's dependent on how Iannone does, who knows? But it's confirmed for Malaysia as things stand anyway. So yeah, it's hard to imagine he's going to have a great weekend because, you know, coming from World Superbikes, we know that's a tough transition to make. It's the bikes are so radically different now to what he last experienced in, what would that be, 2019 would it have been? I suppose, yeah, somewhere around about there.
So, 4 years to be there, yeah.
It's like, I don't know, jumping out of a biplane into a spaceship, isn't it, really, from his point of view?
Well, hopefully he does well, but we'll see. One of the things we'll be talking about from that round. And that's pretty much it for any kind of news. We will move into the racing, and we'll start with Moto3 qualifying. There is really nothing to be said here in the first qualifying session. I think the only thing that's of interest is the fact that Nepa is in this first qualifying round, but he survives and gets out along with Feroli, Esteban, and Bertelli. They all get through. So we go to the second qualifying session. We're halfway through. Piqueras and Alonso, Holgado, Ortola, Lunetta, and Fernandez are the top six guys. Now, they're halfway done. So we're talking about having like 7.5-ish minutes left on the clock. Okay. And then everyone gets a tire and they all sit. We've seen this before. And for some reason, we'd like to do this at Thailand. I don't know why we sort of do this at Thailand, but I guess it's the really long straights because it's really only the long straights. We kind of see this at Mugello with a long straight. We see it at Catalonia with the long straight. And here we have a pretty good length of stretch as well. And so everyone sits and they're waiting. Now, with 6 minutes left, Vire decides to get out and get on with the program. Okay. So we're waiting some more. There's 2 minutes 30 left. No one else is going out. Everyone stays stationary. It's like, guys, it's like a pole lap is a 1 minute 40 something. You've got to get going because you've got the pit speed limiter. Of course, finally, it's like 1:45 left to go, and they all run out onto the track. And oh, Rich, who the head of Aspar,
Jorge Martinez.
he's just shaking his head like, "What are you people thinking?" From the pit lane, right? So the basically it was like whoever could get out, get around quick, they would be the first people to actually get. You want to be that last person, right? So that you just get to the start finish line with a second or so to go. That was who's going to be in there. Well, half of these guys don't even make it. They're not even. Alonso doesn't get a lap. I mean, all the fast guys don't seem to get a lap at all. The last man to get across was Joel Kelso. And interestingly enough, it looked like Piqueras had it with Alonso second and then Holgado. But all of a sudden, we caught wind of Kelso having red helmets, and he was that last guy just to barely get there, just in time. And so he rode the best lap of his life, and he goes to pole. I was really proud to see Kelso get a pole. He's been working hard for it. He had a great start to the year. Things were looking really up when we talked to him at COTA, and then he had the accident, or not the accident, but he got run off at COTA's infamous turn. I think it's nine. And from there, things sort of kind of went downhill. And now he's finally sort of rebounded and has come back up. And he has his first ever pole. So Kelso has the pole. Vire was second. Then it was Piqueras. Then Furusato. Then Alonso in fifth. He didn't even get a good lap at the end. He was completely in the pack of everybody who was wandering around on the reservation trying to figure out who they were going to follow or whatever. Then it was Ogden, Holgado, Almanza, Ortola, and Lunetta. So that is how they qualified out of there. So we will then move into the race on Sunday morning. Now, it rained with heavy thunderstorms overnight, and there was a prediction that had been stated on Friday that the MotoGP race could be affected by rain, as there was a forecast of rain during that time. Well, in the heat and the humidity of it, the rain was well overnight and had left the track drenched, and so the track was drying, like it had dry patches to it, but there were still as many dry patches, there was as many damp patches. So that changed how the Moto3 race was going to run as a schedule. So because there had not been any wet session prior to the race, race direction declared the race wet. That meant that because the race had been declared wet and there had been no practices that weekend in the wet conditions, that the riders were given a 10-minute session to go out, make a lap, and make as many of those laps as they wanted. But they had to come back through pit lane and go around it because people were warming up or setting up on the grid. They were running around trying to figure out who was going to be there and who was going to do what. But also, along for the rules, because we have a 10-minute session at the beginning, the race will be shortened to two-thirds distance. So we went down to a 12-lap sprint race, if you will. And we basically had to figure out, were we going to go on wets or were we going to go on slicks? That was the question that everybody had. I know you didn't see this, but I'm going to ask you intuitively if you know who this is. Who was the very last rider to roll up onto the grid, Rich? Because I know you didn't have time or we can see all the
Yeah, I'm
qualifying
at a
here.
slight disadvantage because I only
Yes.
saw the races on playback. But well, I'm gonna guess Alonso.
That is correct.
Yeah.
The last man, the man who took the most laps, who did a lot of time, took the whole 10-minute session. He did the most laps of anybody. Last guy to pull to the grid, David Alonso.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, Okay. What's this kid got figured out that nobody else has figured out? But it appeared, though, that nobody was going to go for the gamble of Wets. I think one or two riders in the back did gamble on Wets, but the contenders all decided to start on their slicks, except for Alonso is on a medium slick and not a soft slick. So it's like, whoa, we have that Australia thing again where Alonso is on a t off tire to everybody else, which was pretty wild to get him. So there was a fair amount of drama and goings on, as it were, before we ever got a chance to drop the green flag. But at the start, Kelso took off. He got the whole shot. He's followed by Viar, Piqueras, Furusato, Alonso, Horgado. But Viar would get by Kelso, and Viar would lead. And Kelso starts to sort of go backwards a little bit here as everybody kind of roughs him up as they sort of go through, because he would get stood up in a corner, and well, two or three other vultures were going to come flying through on you, which is the norm for Moto3. Kelso had got himself bumped back to like fifth, but he did rebound for a little bit, and he did get himself back up to third. But Alonso would start leading by that point, and we had a seven bike group of Moto3 bikes, which is usually what happens. Kelso did get back by Alonso as Alonso dropped back, and then Furusato stood Alonso up and stood up Kelso, I should say. And then Alonso just went right through too. So those guys, as soon as one of them makes one mistake, gets pushed off, everybody was going through, and that's where it was. So now we had Kelso back to seventh. Now Furusato seemed to be looking like he wanted to clear off. We're halfway done, so he's got six laps, and so he's sort of turning the laps, and he's leading for a last little bit here. But Alonso stealthily works his way through the pack of other riders to get himself right behind Furusato, and eventually he leads with five laps to go. Now, that's when they told us, hey, look, he's got the medium rear and the medium front, where everybody else is pretty much guaranteed to be on the soft front, soft rear, which is really interesting. Alonso then started leading the fourth lap, but Piqueras is riding super duper aggressive. He's just everywhere. If there's an inch, Piqueras is going through it. I think he is probably the most aggressive Moto3 rider on the grid, and it works for him, which is in stark contrast to the precision at which Alonso slices through everyone. It's like one is this clinical surgeon, very precise, very calculated, and the other one is just the raging bull in a china shop that's just going for it 24/7. And it's amazing how they have, essentially the same bike. They have a KTM. Each of them, no, sorry, Piqueras is on the Honda, sorry. So maybe he's got to ride the Honda a little differently than what Alonso can ride the KTM. But they're different, but they're both fast, which is, again, a unique circumstance that they're so far apart in riding styles, and they seem to work. With that, we got down to three to go, and Lunetta had made his way to fourth. He had bridged the gap and had gone through and had gotten himself up and possibly was chasing a podium, because he had gotten out, pushed out wide, and sort of beaten up at the early part of the race. So he was now on form to come back, which was there. And it's like, we had two laps, and Ortolo had now gone to second. He was chasing Alonso, and then it was like, well, where do you look? Because everybody was passing somebody at some corner somewhere in these last two laps. It's like, it was Piqueras, Fernandez. They were both down. Ortolo was leading with one to go, behind with Alonso and Furusato chasing him with Lunetta. Then Alonso got to the front about halfway around the lap. I think he did it coming out of three or going into four, the blind crest at four. I think he blind entry to four, he got in there. It was the last came down as always to the last corner of what was going to happen. Ortolo goes for it and he goes up the inside, but he can't hold it. He runs it wide. Then Lunetta winds up going up the inside as well with Viar, who's what's the cut under. And then Viar touches Furusato, who was there as they're like three wide coming out of the corner. This causes Furusato to crash, and then he winds up bike and rider sliding across the line with all that craziness. That last corner is a bonkers last corner, which, I mean, you have a long stretch, you have a nice tight turn. It's an outbreaking game with the shortest dash to the finish line. There's going to be chaos at the last lap. And sure enough, there was with this Furusato crash. But Alonso did win. Lunetta was second. Viar would take third. Then you had Ortola in fourth. Now they gave Furusato fifth. I was afraid they would not classify him at all because the rule states that the bike and rider must cross the finish line together. They did not, but they came up with some way of, well, it really wouldn't have mattered because he could have got back up and mounted the bike and pushed it across the line, or something that says like, oh, you know, it's okay that he's fifth, which I think that's a little bit of another topic we can kind of delve into here when we get through the whole part of the rundown. But first, Otto was then fifth, then Munoz came through, Kelso was seventh, Ogden was eighth, Nepa, Suzuki, Yamanaka, Holgado having a miserable time this weekend. Then Ricardo Rossi, Feroli, and Rolstein got a point. It was also a track that he Jacob is familiar with riding in the Pan Asia. I think they call it the Pan Asia Cup or something like that. So that is how the race finished. I will go on to say that Alonso, I have run out of superlatives. The baby goat is real. 12 wins in a season. That's the first time anybody's won that many in a Moto3 championship. I can't remember if anyone's done more in a season in 1-5. But for MotoGP, he has won the most of, or Moto3, the four-stroke era, he has won the most races of anyone in the season. He then has 5 wins in a row to beat Marquez's record of 4 in a row, and when Marco had 125. There's nothing I can say. This kid is amazing. He is rewriting the record book as he goes, and I only hope that this kid will continue to rewrite the record book as he goes through Moto2. And every time I see him do another race of strategy, technique, intelligence, I just get super mouth watery over the idea of him v Acosta in MotoGP, because by that time Acosta is going to be the old hand, because it's going to be at least 2 more years before he, i.e. Alonso, can get to MotoGP. So that's going to be interesting. Rich, thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, as I say, I only kind of watched it on my mobile phone, which is never the best way to watch any race. But I was a little bit disappointed that the race had fell short. And thank you for explaining why it was. I wasn't aware of the sort of 10-minute practice that preceded the race. Interesting, as you say, that Alonso spent the most time out gauging the conditions and came up with that slightly unusual, well, unusual to everybody else, tire choice. But there's always method in the. I was going to say madness, but it's not madness with him, really, is it? Because it's, yeah, everything's under control all the time, isn't it? It seems with David Alonso. I know you haven't heard it yet, Jim, so I won't preempt it, but I've just put out the at last one of the Silverstone shows where I'm chatting to Hervé Poncharal. We talk about sort of the mouth-watering prospect of Alonso turning up in MotoGP. You won't be surprised to learn that Poncharal is a fan.
Oh yeah, he's definitely a fan.
I don't want to keep sort of repeating the same thing over and over because people will get bored of us saying it, but he does bear direct comparison to Pedro Acosta. Whereas, you were picking out earlier on as an example, but by no means alone. But let's pick on Piqueras. He was early on in his Moto3 Grand Prix career, it's true, but he kind of has the whiff of a Denis Onchu about him, doesn't he? But, spectacular, but maybe not erratic, perhaps not right the word. Certainly aggressive. But the sort of rider that you might see stall for a season or two in Moto2. So again, I know I've said it hundreds of times, but one last time, I'm interested to see if Alonso makes the quick transition in Moto2 like Acosta did because of that spare capacity that we've spoken about so much in everything that he does. It just gives them that leg up on everybody else as a rookie into the next class that they go to. As we've seen with varying degrees of success, it's true with Acosta in MotoGP this year, but he is riding a KTM and he's by far and away outstripping all of the other KTM riders. So, you have to judge him on that, not how he compares to, say, Ducati riders, because they are not the same thing at all. So, yeah, I mean, Jim, you just, as you said, you run out of superlatives really with Alonso, don't you? Now, it is true. I mean, always want to sort of just temper the enthusiasm around stats, around the fact that he is racing in a very large calendar in terms of the number of races, so he has more opportunity to win more races in a season than, say, Valentino Rossi did back in what 97 when he was in 125s, whose record he has just recently broken in terms of wins in a season. So, I mean, you have to slightly temper your enthusiasm around realities such as that, but nevertheless, I mean, you can only judge him on his performance against his peers, and I mean, he's made everybody else look pretty ordinary this year, hasn't he? So, nothing much more to say, really. I can well see him winning Malaysia, and it's not a big stretch to see him winning in Valencia either.
No.
And I kind of hope he does, because if he can just add to these stats, it just, yeah, kind of just makes this year, his world championship winning year, even better, really. But other than that, nothing too much to say about the race, really, from my side, in terms of the slightly marginalized way that I got to watch it on my mobile phone.
Yep. So when I get into these situations, like, well, there was more races, I like to do it by win percentage, right? So I think there's 20 rounds this year, right? And Alonso has won his 12 of 20. That gives him a 60% strike rate to win. I think this is off the top of my head. I think there was 15 rounds in 1997. I think that gave Rossi a 73% strike rate. So it's very comparable statistically that they're striking at the same rate, which is, again, if you're going to hold me to it, I'm going to say, well, Rossi had a better strike rate because he had less races, right? But I would then counter that and say, I think the people racing today, the quality of the quote kids who are racing today is probably greater than what Rossi's was back in 97.
Well, I would say certainly the quality of the equipment across the
Oh,
entirety of
yes.
the field is way
Oh,
above what it
definitely.
was back in the days where you had a good two-stroke or an old one. It's not entirely correct because I know, for example, having spoken to the Vision Track, although it's not called Vision Track anymore, is it? But the Michael Laverty team, I mean, I know they're running sort of like 3-year-old bikes, so I mean they are quite a step down in performance. I believe that's correct. That's kind of what I've been told anecdotally. So there are some variances within the field, but I don't think anything like existed in the 1990s for sure. So I think on that basis, you know, that does elevate Alonso back up again, even though his percentage might be a little bit lower. Let's be honest, he's a superstar already. I
Oh,
mean, he's
yeah.
going to be a massive superstar going forward. So, you know, quality always rises to the top, and that's just what we've seen throughout the whole of this year and most of last year as well. Let's not forget, because he won a handful of races last year as well. So, yeah, just brilliant. Nothing more to say, really. Just like a broken record, really, but he's just outstanding.
He is one of those ones that's special for sure. So obviously, Alonso is your world champion. He's been world champion, but the race now is for who will be second in the championship. Helgado holds on to his second place. However, Vire is now only 11 points behind him. If Helgado has a bad Malaysia, a bad Valencia, and perhaps maybe Vire catches a win in one of those two places, he can easily become second in the championship. Ortola is fourth in the championship. He is a 21 points behind. Further 21 points behind Vire. So that gets him, 32 behind Holgado. That's with 50 points left to play. That's, getting kind of tough there. So the battle now is for who is going to be second. Then Munoz is the fifth man, Fernandez, Piqueras, Rueda, Kelso up to ninth, and then Yamanaka in 10th. And that is all we have for Moto2. We will move to Moto, or we had for Moto3. We will move to Moto2. And we'll go through their qualifying. So this qualifying again is a little bit bland here. We had I think the interesting person that's in the first session is Agius. Senator Agius is there. He had a great podium down in Australia. Thought he'd carry that momentum in again another track that he knows, but he didn't. He was in that first session again. But Chantra was there, and I have to mention Chantra's livery on the bike was pretty darn cool. It was based on a lion, and I thought that was a brilliant one of my favorite. And that one's in the top five of liveries for Jim. That's a
Oh, wow.
that was a really, really good one. I think the Casserole Hondas of the Colin Edwards era are kind of sort of my second favorite. My favorite of all time is Doohan's 94 Honda because it just was HRC. It was before Repsol, and I love that bike for whatever reason. But it was the wild 90s. It had the pinks and the purples and all that other stuff in it. So anyway, different times, different times, different times. So that so as I said, Binder, so Chantra actually came through a bunch of traffic to be there as the first position to go through. Binder, Garcia, and Sasaki went with him to the second session. We've seen Garcia here again. I thought maybe he was turning a corner with the island. It's not. He's right back into that first session again. So then we get to talk here. Oh, let's do that right before. Let's do that before we get to the race. We'll talk about the weird Arbolino incident, which I don't think you saw. You may have heard or seen snippets of it, but we'll talk about that for the race. We'll talk about that pre-race. So we'll go through the qualifying here. Halfway through, Agura, who can become world champ this weekend, is leading things. Then Canet, then Marrera, and then Ramirez, Audiger, and Arenas. Now, everyone goes out together at the end, and the pack basically kind of screws up like Alcoba's run. He was running through, the pack was there. He had to let off, come through the pack, so his lap got botched through all of that. Iagura just pulls out of it all and says that I'm already on pole. If you can beat me, go ahead. I don't really care. And he thinks that, hey, that's it, I've got it. Well, Kennett was going to give it a shot because he had gotten through the pack, had turned it on. He was turning in red helmets and he was going pretty darn quick, but he did tuck the front slightly at 12, and that cost him, I think, maybe a tenth or maybe two. And that left Iagura on pole with Canet second. Marrera would be third. Then Arbolino, Ramirez, Salak, Arenas, Audiger, and Garcia, who did qualify ninth. So, I mean, he seemed to kind of get it together as they got to. But we would get to move forward then to the race on that Sunday. Now, okay, let's see if I can put this together for you all to get it together. Arbolino was going to get a 3-grid place penalty for an incident that occurred in practice. So if you know the circuit, they come out of 11, which is the right-hander heading to 12 with a decent straightaway that's there. The entrance to the pit is right after 11. And so it is, as they show you looking at the riders, it's to rider left. Arbolino had high-sided out of 11 and had gone to pick up his bike and wanted to bump start it and go back to the pits. The marshals wanted him to use the service road that was on the other side of the fence separating the track and ride back to the pits in that way. Arbolino refused and tried to bump start his bike on the entry to pit lane. Now, his bike, I think he kind of maybe got it going, but he stalled it again, or the bike quit on him again. Arbolino standing is there with a dead engine bike. A marshal is running to him to assist, and Van de Garberg, who's paying zero attention to anything of what's going on, at the last second realizes that Arbolino is a stationary motorcycle and weaves between Arbolino and the corner marshal, who's coming to help assist Arbolino. A scary situation. Luckily, everybody involved was okay. Van de Gerberg is fine, was fine. Arbolino is okay, but he's not going to be okay because he has severely bruised his heels or his feet in the high side that he had. And then you had the corner marshal, who I think ducked it at the last second. He was okay as well. So for those infractions, you had Arbolino getting a 3-grid penalty, and Van de Gerberg would be forced to start from the pit lane. I thought those penalties were a little weird, given all of what happened. It's like, okay, so Arbolino gets a grid penalty, but you make Van de Gerberg start from the pit lane. To me, they're both as equally wrong in this situation. So to me, the penalties should have matched each other. So either Van de Gerberg should have been back 3 places on the grid, or Arbolino should have started from pit lane. Take your pick, wherever you want to put them. But it's like, it wasn't like Arbolino was the innocent victim here who then had a problem. It just bizarre how they decided that that was what they were going to do with it. It just left me going, I don't get it. And I mean, we've seen this from race control. I mean, we get Simon Crafar as the new race director slash enforcer, if you will, for this. And I hope Simon at least becomes fair and consistent across the board. Consistent is all I'm really asking for here out of this one. I don't know if you have any thoughts about that, Rich, as far as the penalties go that they got, but I'll give you the floor.
Well, I'm glad that you've filled in some of the blanks in my knowledge, because again, I didn't get to see practice or qualifying particularly. I did see the incident on Twitter because obviously there was a lot of people reporting on it. So I saw the incident, but not the context of how it kind of happened. My understanding, and again, I might be wrong on this, my understanding is that the riders should know that they're not supposed to try and bump bikes back into life on a live racetrack, and the pit lane entry is part of the live racetrack. Whether or not he was directed or was ignoring an instruction from a or the marshal that became a bigger part of the incident, I'm not quite sure, but I think he wasn't supposed to be doing what he was doing. So that's the Arbolino bit. The Van der Gerbig bit. Well, I mean, he's coming into pit lane 999 times out of 1,000. I'll just come in to pit lane and that'll be it. They'll be looking at the dash. They'll be, I don't know, looking at whatever. So they wouldn't necessarily expect to see a Marshall or a stationary bike in the pit lane. And, you know, they are still moving quite fast and it's not that long a piece of track as they come into the pit lane, particularly because Arbolino is halfway towards turn 11. So I'm not trying to excuse what Van der Gerber didn't see, but it doesn't take much of a lapse of judgment. I mean, we've all done it. I've certainly done it on my bike on the road many a time. You know, you're kind of looking at something around you or your mirror, and suddenly something's in front of you, and you think, oh crap, you know, and you sort of sticking the anchors on for all you're worth. So, I mean, that sort of thing can happen. I mean, like you, Jim, I think on the basis of whether or not that's more or less correct, I would have to conclude that I would have thought the penalties were around the wrong way because it was Arbolino that kind of caused the incident, not on purpose. I'm not suggesting he did anything dangerous, and it's perfectly understandable that he wanted to get his bike going again. But if he broke a rule in doing it and caused an accident, or at least instigated an accident, then I would have thought the burden of responsibility falls more heavily upon him. Yes, Van der Gerberg was pretty negligent in not seeing what was in front of him. You can certainly argue that, but at the very least, I would have thought they should have had an equal penalty, as you say, Jim. So I think, yeah, at least that's what should have been. It seemed extraordinarily harsh on Van der Gerberg to have to start from the pit lane. But anyway, I mean, feel free to disagree, people. And, you know, I'd say I haven't seen or read or done all of the research on it like others might have done, but that was my, well, that is my kind of lightweight take on it.
Yeah, you can like it, you can dislike it. To me, it was just both of these guys committed, in my mind, a safety issue, right? Bump starting a bike on a live track, bozo no no. Not paying attention to what you're doing on a live track, also bozo no no. So I get it though. I understand because I could tell you there's a number of times that, I mean, I don't know. For me, when I was racing, it was a I, for whatever reason, didn't. I paid the most attention when I was getting off the track heading into the pits. I can't really explain to you why. Like, I don't have a great answer, but that to me was the scariest part of it. And maybe because I've seen enough dirt track races where people would let off right after the finish line, or and people bump into each other and go down. Or I've just because I, you know, I remember the Bubba Chobert incident at Laguna Seca in 89. You know, I was still dirt tracking then. And so it's like, well, wait a minute, I'm on a really faster, much faster bike now, going a lot faster. Hey, I got to pay more attention to what's going on. I don't really know. I just, to me, those are like there's certain things that are like inexcusable at a racetrack. And to me, both of those are pretty close to being inexcusable. If I'm running the show, I put them both in the pit lane.
Yeah. The
That's where I was.
grisly cynic in me, Jim, suspects that had the marshal not been on track and that accident had happened, neither of them would have got a penalty.
Yeah, because if the marshal isn't there, then Van de Gerberg just swerves around him and rides off. So yeah, you're probably right.
I think that race direction tends to react to things that they think, oh, that was a close one, we better penalise somebody. And, you know, had a marshal would he was just there, you know, volunteering, doing his job, no protection, so to speak, compared to the riders in terms of safety gear. If he'd got clattered, I mean, he would have been nastily hurt, maybe not sort of seriously injured, but nevertheless, a bike travelling at what, 20 or 30 mile an hour hitting a soft, flabby human body is going to do quite a bit of damage. So sometimes it just feels like they come down on riders like a ton of bricks because of something that might have happened. And I think had the marshal not been there, I'm not sure that they would have made that big a deal of it. Which I'm not saying they shouldn't have done because fundamentally, Arbolino shouldn't have been doing what he was doing. So, yeah, your experience is interesting there, Jim. It's a little bit like this whole thing, and I won't go off on a. This is perhaps for an off-season show, but you know, my hatred of the sort of the infringement penalty for not slowing down enough on a yellow flag. No, the yellow flag or the yellow board means you should slow down, not you haven't slowed down enough. I mean, it's meant to be slow down, there's danger ahead. You might get yourself or somebody else into bother. Whereas now they kind of go through about as fast as they think they can get away with, and they might cop a penalty for it. And that's not the intention of a yellow flag.
There's a small difference in here, and it can be semantic, but the first part of it is there should be a stationary yellow flag to alert you that there is danger coming, and then
Yes.
a waving yellow where the incident is. One of the things they told us, And they would always kind of remind people of this every few races, at the club level at least, was, hey guys, a yellow flag doesn't mean let off. A stationary yellow does not mean let off. It means, hey, there's something coming up that you need to start thinking about and put in there, like start looking for the waving yellow, looking for a motorcycle on track, look for a person on track, look for debris on track, something. That's how that was always explained to us. And so I don't have a problem with them going fast at that point. But as soon as you get to that waving yellow, yeah, you've got to be out of it.
Yeah, fair point.
I'm not trying to nitpick you, Rich,
No,
at all.
that was always a fundamental part of it. Was a stationary or a waved yellow was absolutely critical to its meaning and its intent. And yes, you're totally right.
So either way, anyway, well, we'll go to race day here. So with race day, the race was declared dry. We had the rain from the morning, the thunderstorm, Moto 3 race declared wet, but was everybody race slicks anyway. The interesting part about that one was, I never did mention it, but I thought for a second, like, wait a second, if everybody's on slicks on a race that was declared wet, they can't stop it by putting their hand up if it rains. So if it would have rained and they all had slicks on, they would have had to have tried to finish that race on slicks.
Or race direction stops it on safety grounds.
On safety grounds. Yeah. But the riders couldn't stop it because,
No.
oh, hey, it's starting to rain or whatever. Anyway, small point. Again, safety. Well, we're aware. Okay. On to race day. So this Moto2 race is declared to be dry. Agura can be world champion. The simple math is if he finishes in the top five, anywhere in the top five, he will have enough points that he will be world champion with the amount of races that are with two races left to go. So that is what we're doing as far as the calculations that we're going to try to keep here as we go in. Start of the race, it's going to be the full distance. It's going to be the 22 laps. Iagura gets the whole shot, followed by Canet, Marrera, and Arbolino. Then as they got down into turn three, man, it's like Canet just, goes in, Lehrer leads. Furman Aldeguer has a crash at turn five. And then Arbolino is taken out of that as a result of that crash that's there. Then at 12, Lopez and Marrera barge into one another, and they barge not Iagura down to, I believe, sixth place or fourth place at the beginning of the race. So the first lap was pretty much chaos for the boys in Moto 2. Thought there had been more penalties that would have been thrown out for it, but that first lap, everybody sort of gets away with murder. And when you know that you can get away with murder, you will become an axe murderer. That is how that works. I'm
Yep.
sorry, I can tell you that from firsthand experience for sure. Lopez had a blunder at turn five on lap with 20 to go. Canet, Ramirez, Dixon was up front now. He had come from nowhere to be there. Then it was Binder and Marrera. Iagura was now sixth. He's sixth. He's got to get one more place. So Iagura then goes by Binder. It was pretty rough. Iagura did barge him around a little bit, but Binder was at the curb, wasn't necessarily over the curb. So they let that one go. I was holding my breath for a minute because now I has got fifth place, so he can be world champion. And then you're waiting for the long lap of inconvenience to show up for irresponsible riding or something. I had that scare that was going on. Iagura had gotten by Binder, as we said. Binder went to the car park. I mean, did he really have to go there? He could have finished the turn, I think, with where he was. He was just out on the curb and then he decided, oh, I'm gonna go farther. Well, there was that like sausage type curb that's at the end of the curbing that he kind of bounced over. I don't know about that one, but he was definitely out there for sure. So Canet's still leading over Ramirez. Iagura gets by Arenas to become fourth. Binder then is down and out at turn eight. And then we got 13 laps to go. Iagura gets by Morbidelli, Morbidelli gets by Marrera. So Iagura is now third. So Iagura has worked himself to the podium. Canet and Ramirez are still there, with Agura now third. Then Iagura got by Ramirez at turn three. He took the undercut. Some people go in wide, square it off. Some people want to diamond it and shoot it back out. Iagura was able to get in there, get that. So he's actually second position. At that point, we got to 7 laps to go. There were spots of rain. The rain flag, the white one with the red cross on it, was being displayed in certain corners of the track with the rain there. With five to go, Canet ahead of Agüero and Ramirez. And then Chantra has now moved his way to fourth. So again, we're sort of focused on the front battle with Iaguro. Where is he at? We're not seeing what's happening in the back of the pack, but they did at least like, whoa, hey, here comes Chantra at the very end. So for him to be fourth was great. With two laps to go, the red flags come out. It's now raining. They don't want to get into a situation here. And so they just basically call it at that point. That meant that Kinect would get the win. I think that's Kinect's second or third win now, I think, overall that he's had. Because I know I think it's third. Then Iaguro would finish second, which made Iaguro the world champion. So Iaguro is the first Japanese champion of the Moto 2 class. And he's the first Japanese champion. I did not write it down on my notes as to who was how long it's been since there was a Japanese champion in the two. I think it was Harada. It was no, was it Aoki who won the very last 250 title? It was whoever won the very last 250 title was the last Japanese champion. So that was 2009, I think. 2008 was the last 250 champion.
Was it Hiroshi Aoyama, maybe?
It might be that.
I'm
I
trying to
might
think if he
be.
won a championship. I
I think he did. I think he was
thought he
the
did.
last champion.
I know Dajiro Kato won prior to that, but then you're going back to
Right. You're, yeah.
2001, 2002, maybe. So, yeah, would need to check on that. But yes, I mean, it's been a long time.
Been a
So,
long time.
yeah, it's good for Japan to have, given
13 years.
the relative doldrums that they're in from a manufacturer's point of view at the minute, it's great for them to have a rider that's doing well.
It is. I mean, HRC is prominently on the shoulder of Iger's leathers, and I'm willing to bet $1 against a donut that those three letters will be on his leathers at Trackhouse.
Oh, I thought you were going to say that they would disappear.
No.
Ah, interesting.
I firmly believe that they will be on his leathers at Trackhouse. I am a firm believer of that one.
I mean, I know we've commented on it before, and certainly I think when I or Martin had chatted to Simon Patterson back earlier in the year or back in the last year, he pointed out certainly to me about the HRC affiliation still being on Aigura's leathers and the fact that he rides for the MT Helmets squad and still has an Arai helmet. So he's very supported from Japan, which, shouldn't come as a big surprise, but there are, a few kind of lines being crossed in terms of what you would normally see with sponsorship deals, given potential kind of clashes of interest. Let's just put it that way. So, yeah, interesting, Jim. Let's keep careful note of that next year in
We
terms
will.
of what he's got on his shoulder. Yeah. Like you, I was checking it out just to remind myself if it was still there. And although he had his sort of winner's bib on in Parc Fermé, you could just see the RC bit, couldn't you? So it was still there. Yeah. So it'll be interesting to see if that level of sponsorship, because you must assume that Honda Racing Corporation still hope that he will be the prodigal son that potentially comes across in a year or two's time. At the end of the day, these riders are going to go for the best competitive package they can get onto if they can establish themselves within any given category. So they'll be hoping beyond hope, I would imagine, that Aigura might be a potential target still to come back home, as they will see it, a few years down the line.
With that, with Aguirre being second, he is world champion. Then Ramirez finishes off the podium. Chantra for fourth in his home country. Great ride for him. I mean, the crowd was just going crazy for him. Then Moreira, Guevara, Dixon, Arenas, Gonzalez, Anchu, Lopez, Garcia with only 4 points finishing in 12th. Sasaki, Flach, and Navarro take the last. And Navarro takes the last point. Then we move to the championship. As we said, this puts Iaguro on 261 points. He is 60 points clear of Aaron Canet. So with two races left and 50 points available, he then is world champion. Garcia has now slipped to third as Canet is second, and he is a full 22 points behind Aaron Canet, which is crazy. Audiger is only four behind Garcia, and if Audiger would have stayed on the bike, he would have probably be ahead of Garcia. I think it's a foregone conclusion that Audiger finishes third in the championship, for sure. Then after that, fifth is Gonzalez, then Lopez. Joe Roberts is sunk to seventh. Dixon, Vietti, and Arbolino in the top 10. Rich, anything else for the Moto 2 guys before we hop to Moto GP?
Did we touch upon Aldegar's faux pas at the beginning of the race? I mean, he was completely out of control, didn't he?
Yeah, he completely and utterly, we didn't go into it in detail, and I guess we should have at that point. But yeah, he completely and totally blew the corner. It was, he had no intention of being able to stop that motorcycle heading into that corner
Yeah.
whatsoever. And he just plowed into everybody and anybody that was there. I mean, he used them as a brake. They were the berm to his excitement.
Who did he take out? He took one or two riders with him, didn't he? And I'm just trying to, because I didn't make notes because of where I was.
Let's see
I
if I
don't
got any of
remember,
my
but I'm wondering if he will get a penalty of some description at Malaysia this weekend for
Yeah.
that. Because, I mean, it's hard to foresee that he won't have some form of penalty for that move, because he was effectively off the bike and crashing before he even touched another rider going into that
Yes.
corner.
From my notes, I just had that Audiger crashed at turn five, taking out Arbolino. He had come from a
Oh, Arbolino.
very,
Yeah.
yeah, he had taken it, come from a very, very long distance back. Has no way he was going to stop the bike. And then a lap or two later, the stewards decided that they would review this after the race. And I have not I have not seen or heard anything about what penalty Audiger may receive for the Malaysian round. I've got to believe he's going to get three grid place penalty. I
Yeah.
think that's probably going to be the norm. I mean, they could give him a double long lap, but I don't know. I think it'd be easier for them just to give him a three place grid penalty there.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he'll get something for that, and capping off a pretty wretched weekend for poor old Tony Arbolino.
You get a feel for Tony, and I kind of feel for Audiger. I don't know, for a guy who was dominant at the end of the season on that chassis on Dunlaps, and then he, has not figured the Pirelli out. I mean, that's the only thing I can think of, because Lopez looks good on the bike, but he does win on it. That's the strange part, is that he, you could say, well, he just doesn't understand the Pirelli. Well, he's won two or three races on the Pirelli on that bike. He won at Qatar at the beginning of the year, if I remember correctly. He had another win somewhere. Did he win at Aragon? I think maybe. I don't. It's a bit fuzzy right now for
Yeah,
me, but
possibly.
somewhere. So he's won a couple, at least a couple races, if not three. And you're going, what is wrong with him? Like, it's hot and cold. And I don't know if it's like, I was trying to think if it was like temperature related, because I know he won a Qatar, but that's a night race, and it's cooler there, but still warm and humid, if you'll take that one. So, again, he won, and he was looking, fairly good here in Thailand, kind of like a warm temperature thing. I just don't know what's wrong. I'd love to know. I'd love to be able to ask, like, what, I mean, he's note to Jim, go find him at COTA and say, what, why didn't you gel within last year with it? Because you should have been the dominant winner of a Moto2 World Championship, but you didn't. I mean, this is the championship that nobody wanted to win, in all honesty. You
Yeah.
kind of got that feeling. It was like it was all over the place. You thought maybe Roberts was going to have a shot at it, but then injuries, misfortune, bad judgment. Garcia was then the runaway champion at that point, and suddenly he doesn't get a ride on a MotoGP bike, and it just comes crashing down on him. Iagura just basically didn't decide to show up until halfway through the season, but Iagura was recovering from a very bad wrist injury
True.
that even though I think he rode some last year after it healed, I don't think he was race fit until this year. And even then, I don't think he was comfortable with how his wrist was working until halfway Silverstone in August, because that's when he finally started to come alive. And then it's just like the perfect storm of Iagura just, consistently being there. So, very weird championship, this
It
one.
has been a particularly odd championship this year, with people kind of shining briefly and then just, falling away again. I mean, let's not forget, I mean, Dixon had a real purple patch in the sort of the last
Yeah.
or the beginning of the sort of final third of the season, and he's kind of just dropped away again. As you say, the strange case of Sergio Garcia. I mean, Aguirre, taking nothing away from him, I mean, he's an absolutely worthy champion, but it's kind of been done on stealth in a way. Well, that's kind of how it feels to
Yeah.
me. I mean, he's won a two or three races, I think, hasn't he? Vietti's popped up once or twice. It's just been very sort of topsy-turvy championship, and Aldegar is a real head scratcher. Having said all of that, I mean, he was attracting, if you remember, at the beginning of last year, before he went on that kind of rip at the end of the year. I think I'm right in remembering that around the time of Argentina, which was at the beginning of last season, I think it was last season, not the season before.
They didn't have Argentina last year.
Okay, so it was the season before then. He was kind of being linked to the Aprilia squad at that point in MotoGP and decided to stay put, which I think was the right decision. maybe just sort of like hit one of these little kind of short sweet spots of form at the end of last year, and it kind of clouded people's judgment a little bit because he has been kind of up and down prior to that and ever since. But then again, as we've just said, so he's pretty much the entire Moto2 field, so it's really hard to judge, isn't it? And throw in different tires, as you say, Jim, and that's kind of added another level of complexity and jeopardy, I suppose. The impressive one, in a way, and it kind of feels almost like a redemption in a way, is Aaron Canet, because I mean, he's doing a bit of a Firmin Aldega this year, isn't he, in terms of this form that he's finding at the end of the season. Having been Mr. Second Place, he's now won a few races and he's starting to look like a guy that can keep that kind of momentum going, given the amount of experience that he has. Doesn't appear to have a problem with the tyres, and he seems to me that he's stopped crashing out of kind of race winning opportunities, which was his big Achilles heel before. So he'll be an interesting one to watch next year. I don't know if he's confirmed to be staying at that same team next year.
I can't say that I know.
We'll need to just double check on that, and perhaps we'll touch back on what's going on in Moto2, in a show or two's time. But yeah, odd season, really odd season. But yeah, Aguirre, worthy winner. I don't think anybody can take that away from him. And it's nice. I always think it's nice for a guy that's going up to the next class, and obviously the Premier class in this particular case, to go up with the championship in his hands. So yeah, well done to him.
Yes, well done, Diagora. Moving to MotoGP. In the first qualifying session, well, all the KTMs are there except Mr. Acosta. Then Digia is in this one, along with Aleix. Aleix has been terrible the last few races. I think he's.
Dire. Well, all season, really.
Yeah, so. Then the Hondas and the Yamahas are there as well. So halfway through, Digia, Quartararo. Quartararo just riding his absolute butt off to do anything with the bike, which is amazing. Then Binder and Miller. Quartararo had the save of the year. I mean, he was front end completely gone and basically just threw the elbow out and down, picked it up, waited for it to grab and did and caught it. But that pretty much used up his tire, so he wasn't going to be able to there. That was at turn five, which is a pretty fast corner, to be honest. Binder and Quartararo are at the top, but Digia has got a red helmet coming at the end of it. Digia would take the first position ahead of that, and you had ahead of it, and Quartararo would go through as well. So when you get to the second session, you had Martin and Marquez. They both had errors on their first lap, so they didn't get the best or the best lap in. But Bagnaia would move to the pole position. Then Mark and Martin lose time in that fourth sector. Like, Bagnaia is really strong on the brakes. He's very good at braking into the really slow turns. He's very adept of being the latest of the late breakers and somehow hauling it down and still parking it at the apex, then shooting that Ducati out. He's perfected that move and it got him to the front. So then we got Marquez is waiting around for Martin, and now he gets behind Martin and he's following along, but he loses the front and crashes. And it's another mistake for Marquez that you just sit there and go, wow, just another one here. I just cannot believe that he did this again. Then Martin fell, which was a shock that Martin had fallen off. He was really going for it because Simon was talking about how for Martin, he's got to go for it. He has to ride his style. He's got to be aggressive. That helps him to focus. And maybe you focused a little too much there, Jorge. Just saying. Just a smidge, maybe. I'm not sure. But, hey, he was going for it. I have to applaud him for that, but I'm thinking we're this far along, and I know it's a psychological warfare that's going on between you and Bagnaia. And if you claim a pole position over Bagnaia, you put the doubt into Bagnaia. I get it. I get why he did it, but wow. But Bagnaia set a 128.7 lap to take the pole. Bastianini was next. Then Martin Zarco had a crash. That kind of botched a few people there at the end because of the yellow flag at turn one. But Bezzecchi would come good at fourth. Marquez would slide down to fifth. Quartararo had another just absolute fantastic lap to be sixth on the Yamaha. Then Acosta in seventh. And then Digi Antonio, Alex Marquez, Maverick Vinales, Morbidelli, and then Zarco because he did have that crash. That is where we were. Now, of interest here, I think, was the fact that Bagnaia was somewhat miffed at his crew because he came back. He had to come back in after he set his pole lap. And then they were talking back and forth to his crew chief. And he, I mean, Bagnaia has never really animated. I mean, he is the definition of ice cold. Come to find out that he was upset because the bike had been short fueled. So there wasn't enough fuel nor enough time to put fuel in the bike to get him out to do a practice start. That I thought was interesting. It's like Bagnaia has not had the best of starts. I think Martin is sort of the man on a mission of starts. He seems to just get fantastic ones. And Bagnaia didn't get a chance to. And that's been sort of his problem, has been the starts. I was like, wolf, okay. This is cannot probably go well, but we would see what would happen when we got to the sprint race. In the sprint, Bagnaia bagged a hole shot and Martin went deep into turn one and he pushed that Bagnaia out wide. That allowed Bastianini and Marc Marquez to get right there and get in there. Bastianini would come out of this with would come into this, get into out of this in the lead. And then you had Bagnaia and Marquez are now fighting each other, and Acosta's there as well. Now Martinez dropped back to basically sixth place. Then Martin got by Acosta at five. Acosta was down at turn three. The kid's still having crashing problems, which is a bit shameful, but it's where he was. Then we had Bastianini out front still, Bagnaia, then Martin there. Now, Marc Marquez was now fourth. Then Martin got by Bagnaia. So that was interesting. But then Martin got a track limits warning. With five laps to go, Bastianini was leading Martin, Bagnaia, Marc Marquez, then Alex Marquez. At two to go, Martin was wide at three, which I thought Maui would give Marquez a chance to get to the podium. It did not. Bastianini wins the race. Martin is second. Bagnaia is third. Marc Marquez is fourth. His brother Alex fifth. Then Morbidelli, Bezzecchi, Gigi Antonio, Brad Binder, Quartararo. Quickly, Rich, before I let you have a say on the sprint. Interesting. DG Dallinia does not go anywhere near the podium celebrations for his rider. He goes to the pit for the Gresini and talks to Marc Marquez, and they had a very long conversation. And it was, and Gigi was kneeling down, looking at Marc in his chair, nodding along, going, okay, taking the mental notes of what this guy needs to have a motorcycle that will win a world championship. If I'm Pecco Bagnaia, I'm not real happy that Gigi's over there. Just saying.
Well, Marquez is the new toy, isn't he? Well, I don't know, actually, that's probably not the right way to put it.
He's the shiny new thing. Let's put it that way.
Well, he's the shiny old thing, really. But
Okay,
yes,
well.
I mean, clearly, Gigi Dallinia, yeah, sort of short of throwing rose petals in the path of wherever Marc Marquez goes, he's almost sort of metaphorically does that, didn't he? Through his
Yeah.
enthusiasm to go and debrief with him after each race or session, even sometimes. So,
Yeah.
yeah. Interesting psychology going on there. The other thing, Jim, just to say about the sprint
Sure.
race results, top eight bikes, Ducatis.
Yeah, Ducati, 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 KTM.
Scary, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean,
And odd, really, because we started off the year with, the hopes that Aprilia would continue to make forward progress, which early on in the season they did, let's not forget. Much of Gary's discussed, but that dominant weekend at COTA that Maverick had on the Aprilia. Acosta's been a bit up and down, but the KTM is clearly not there at the minute, and the Ducatis have just continued to move forward, haven't they? And top eight places in the sprint is a pretty shocking. I mean, brilliant if you're Ducati, but a bit sobering if you're anybody else.
Very true. Now we get to race day. The rain has arrived and it has been bucketing down at different, there's I think 45-ish minutes between the end of the Moto2 race and the MotoGP race, and it's been bucketing down. And when they start to go out for the bikes, that's they're talking about, what's going to happen and whatnot. It's obviously tricky. Oh, sorry. Let's go back. Bagnaia, it comes out race morning that Bagnaia is a little upset about track limits. He himself counted Martin being off four times. And then he says something really interesting that I didn't catch. You're only allowed to do it twice in a sprint race before you have to take a long lap penalty. But the main race, you can do it three times before you're allowed to take the penalty, before you get a penalty. I'm like, I didn't realize that there was a difference between the sprint and
Makes
the
sense.
main race. It
Yeah.
makes sense, though. I mean, when I stop and think about it. But he's like, oh, maybe I was just mistaken. I mean, to me, I look at that and I admit that there was one that was really close. They've got sensors there to determine whether it's going to happen or not. It to me, when he's thinking about that, he's not necessarily thinking about racing, which means that to me, I think it's advantage Martin because I think Martin has gotten underneath Bagnaia's skin. Bagnaia is never going to admit to it. No one's going to say Bagnaia is having a bad time. Mentally, at this stage, before the sprint or before the main race, I'm thinking it's advantage Martin because we're talking about something that you can't control. You can complain, but there's one thing to complain about it, and there's another thing about carry on. It seemed like, Bagnaia wanted to talk about track limits, which I thought was just interesting.
Yeah, it's a bit sort of chip on the shoulder-ish, isn't it? Some of what's
Yeah,
going on.
something. There's some there, but So on the siding lap, Alex Marquez crashes. He seemed confused as to whether he wanted to try to pick up that bike or if he wanted to ride back to the pits or what he what am I gonna do? I mean, he was perfectly okay. It's a low speed tip off. And the thing of it was, I was like, hey, you got to get the bike back because if it's a flag to flag, and if this rain stops, and at that time the rain had stopped, the track was just wet. If it dried, you needed another bike to be have slicks on, So it was like, okay, that whole mess is all going on or whatever, and you're waiting to see what's going to happen. Everyone went to the grid on a medium front and a medium rear wet, which happens to have a harder compound on the right side because there's more rights than there are lefts here. The softs are just a soft compound. I didn't realize that the medium wets had two compounds on them, which that was new. That was a little bit of information I did not know. Makes sense. I understand why you would do that. But everybody was going to be on the reins. As it starts, Martin and Quartararo, who got an absolutely just blinder of a start, and to the point where people were thinking that Martin and Quartararo kind of maybe cheated the light a little bit. But, they looked back at all the replays and found that neither of them had done. Those two just had great starts as it came about. But, Bagnaia was there after these guys got by. Then Mark goes by. So Martin is leading Bagnaia, followed by Marquez, Quartararo, Acosta, and then Binder. So a little bit of a shuffle through the first couple of turns. I think we expected all that. There was definitely some feeling out of the racetrack because there was quite a bit of spray that was coming off of the bikes, and you just didn't know what was going to happen as far as track condition, track dryout. But in this situation like this, you kind of favor Marquez a little bit because he's sort of the master of these iffy conditions. Plus, he has nothing to lose, so he's probably going to push it. We had Bezzecchi down at turn one, and then Quartararo and Morbidelli make contact, and Quartararo is down. A long lap penalty was given to Morbidelli for basically knocking Quartararo down. Sorry, Morbidelli fans, but he just pretty much just clotted him. And it's again, it's kind of like who we were talking about earlier needing the penalty for clotting. Oh, Audegar. You
Oh,
know, it
yeah.
was it looked like Audegar. It was completely too late, out of control, and hop, voila, you're there. And there we go, right? Martin would go wide at turn three, and he falls back to third. So it's Bagnaia, followed by Marquez, followed by Martin. Binder's fourth, then Miller, then Acosta. So Miller worked his way through the wet, magically to get himself there. Morbidelli then falls down at turn eight, although he did have a really good long lap. He went through that pretty darn
Yes.
quick.
Yeah.
For being wet and probably not having gone through there that much over the weekend, he went there. He did a great job of going through it. It's still Bagnaia and Marquez out front. Martin has closed things up a little bit. Bastianini's kind of coming, but we're wondering where the beast actually is going to wind up. Then Marc Marquez makes his first attempt at getting past Bagnaia by trying to outbrake him at 12. It's a tough go, but Bagnaia would hang on. Martin was then off at turn four, and he was coming back on the track. He was flirting with the limits. He went way beyond it there. Not sure what Martin was thinking there, if it was concentration, but he likes to ride fast and hard, so his concentration is acute. But for some reason, he was having a little rough go in the rain. So the top three guys have a 3 second gap to Miller, Binder, and Acosta. Mark tries at 12 again, and Bagnaia cuts back underneath because Mark gets at 12. He can't get it wode. He goes wide. Bagnaia, the smart racer that he is, stays out, cuts under. Uses the drive of the Ducati, down they go. Now, you're thinking, okay, Mark's got some data here. He's going to have to do something. He's going to have to mix it up a little bit. He's not going to really probably get it, or he's going to have to try late in the race, the last lap, second to last lap at 12. Needs to probably look at maybe, he can't get to him at three. Bagnaia's Ducati is much quicker in a straight line than Marquez's. So he's thinking maybe you're thinking five is a possibility, perhaps maybe 10 is a possibility. So I'm thinking like, well, where's Marquez going to go and do his thing? Well, before I can figure out where Marquez is going to do his thing, he does his thing by falling at turn eight.
Yeah.
I mean, unnecessary, but
I mean, it's a wet race, isn't it? Such fine margins. And,
yeah.
well, I mean, we've said all season long that we believe, and let's assume we're partly right, if not fully. Mark is having to kind of override that bike to stay with the 24 bikes. So I think you can give him a bit of a let. If we would fast forward into this race, same conditions next year, and it's him and Bagnaia on the
Nobody's
works
gonna know which
bikes.
way he went.
Well, Mark makes a similar mistake, is the point I'm making. Then you can say, well, okay, that's maybe less one that you can sort of let him off for. But I think the fact that he's on the old 23 bike is possibly does show itself from time to time. But then again, Marquez does have a habit through his career of just crazy pushing and occasionally overstepping the mark. So, I mean, he very, very nearly saved it, Jim, didn't he? It was really just the
Oh, he
curb
tried.
that took the front away from him. Otherwise, had he not been on the curb, I think he would have saved that and he would have carried on in second place,
Yeah, if the
even in the
curb
wet.
wasn't there, yeah, he would have, yes, by all means, he would have carried on and probably won. With 10 to go, Bagnaia has got a 2.7 lead on Martin, who has a 1.9 second lead on Miller, Bender, and Acosta. Acosta goes by Bender with 5 to go, so he's fourth. The question was, can Acosta stand on the podium with 3 to go? Acosta does get by Miller, and they go back and forth through 3, 4, 5, and 6. Finally, Acosta gets by all of that, and he is going to stand on the podium. Bagnaia runs home with the victory. Martin finishes second. Acosta with a well-earned podium in the wet on a MotoGP bike. I thought he was probably the rider of the race for me, just by that alone. Didier Antonio with a great fourth. Then Miller and Bender. Again, we're talking about a rain race. Acosta gets to the podium, and Miller and Bender were a good 3 to 4 seconds slower than what Acosta was. Yeah. Anyway, Vinales was seventh, then Zarco, Aleix, Alex Marquez. Mark Marquez will be credited with 11th because he did remount after his off. He just, that's as high up as he could get. Marini was 12th, Taka Nakagami. So the Honda's making some points there. And then Bastianini was 14th, then Mir and Quartararo was 16th. So that's how the race finished. Let's look at the championship and what this does to it. Martin is on 453. Bagnaia is now on 436. That's a 17-point gap. All Martin has to do in the next four races is finish second in Bagnaia, and he's world champion. The maths are looking pretty slim, but as we saw, Martin's obviously going to be running hard. Track limits may be an issue somewhere. He may get zapped with a long lap penalty. He may not get a good start on the Ducati and be buried in the pack somewhere. And Marc Marquez is out for blood. I don't think he cares one iota whether Martin or Bagnaia is around him at all. He's going for it. And that's kind of what you like about the guy, to be honest. But it does leave the championship in firmer hands now for Martin. I won't say that he has one hand firmly on it. Let's say that. A lot can happen in these sprints. A lot can happen in the races themselves. We're going to Malaysia, hot, humid, could be a tropical thunderstorm shows up, could be a flag to flag. You have no clue. The weather in Valencia may not be worth anything, and it could be crappy all weekend. Who knows? But that's where it is. Marquez has now got a fairly firm grip on third. He's 80 points behind Bagnaia, but Bastianini is only 11 behind him. But Bastianini's hot and cold, and if I had to pick, I'd take Marquez over Bastianini for third in the championship. Bender is fifth, then Acosta is in sixth place, and basically he is only 6 points behind Bender. So it's very possible that Acosta could finish as the lead KTM in the championship. I wouldn't put it past the kid doing that. Vinales is seventh, Di Giantonio eighth, and ninth Morbidelli, and 10th Aleix Espargaró. And that is what we have from Thailand, Rich. Anything else to add?
Not really for Thailand. I mean, Bagnaia, you can certainly say that he, on his good days, and he does have more good days than bad days, it must be said, he is rock solid psychologically when he's under pressure, isn't he? I mean, he was
Oh, he's
under a
great.
lot of pressure in that race. I mean, he could not afford a crash. He had Marquez all over him.
He couldn't afford to lose to Marquez either, to be honest
No,
with you.
he couldn't afford for anything to go wrong, really. And so it was a pretty masterful race by him, given the conditions, both in terms of the weather and obviously the psychological pressure of where he's at in the championship, which is a not in a great place, as you say, because of the fact that Martin doesn't even need to win any more races this year, provided he finishes second. However, having said all of that, it just feels to me this year feels with these two like there's something's going to happen. Somebody's going to drop the ball somewhere. You know, I wouldn't rule Bastianini out in Malaysia because he did win there last year. So it's a track that he goes well at. And okay, he didn't have a great Thailand race, but he did have a good couple of rounds before that. And I think he'll finish off the year strong. He needs to, really, because he's obviously getting off the Ducati. So at the end of this season and going on to the KTM, which will be a bit of a probably a bit of a shock to the system for him. So yeah, I can foresee one or two surprises still coming. It just feels like that's likely to happen because Martin and Bagnaia do have a habit of dropping the ball at various points, don't they? It's which one blinks really now, isn't it? It's a real game of cat and mouse, I think. The other point I was going to say, Jim, just spotting it in the points, because you kindly put the table up on the screen there. Almost as important as who wins between Bagnaia and Martin is that battle for fifth between Acosta and Binder, isn't it? Because that's a bit of a trouser measurement operation going on there as well, in terms of who takes precedence in the works team, given that they'll be teammates next year. So there's a lot riding on those 6 points at the minute. So
Yes,
that
there
one's
is.
worth keeping an eye on.
Yeah, I think that's where my attention is there, as well as at the top. But as a subset of it, watching what happens there is going to be interesting.
One thing we didn't mention in the news, Jim, and it's just very, very briefly as it occurs to me. Although they've come out and sort of vehemently denied any impact on the racing activities, the Pira Mobility Group, is it? I think that the KTM brand is part of, posted some pretty bad financial results this week just gone, I think it was, which has cast a bit of spotlight on other areas of spend within the group, with one or two doom sort of days kind of insinuating that this might bite into the racing activities a little bit. They've come out and said absolutely no. They'll work their way through their commercial issues in terms of road bike sales and off-road bike sales, etc., etc. I mean, KTM, let's not forget, with all their various sub-brands, heavily invested in all sorts of different categories of motorsport, it must, or two-wheeled motorsport anyway. So, you know, they've got fingers in lots of pies, and MotoGP is obviously one of the premier things that they're doing, certainly in terms of road racing at least, and is a significant financial burden to them, it must be said. So that hopefully isn't something that's going to play any part in the coming few years. But they are rationalizing back to KTM. So GasGas we know is going. I think the Husqvarna name is going to disappear as well,
Correct.
bit by bit. So I think this is partly the reason why those sorts of activities are going on, is to kind of, yeah, just kind of simplify things a little bit and streamline where they can. But slightly concerning, because it's not a great time to be in the business of selling motorbikes for any manufacturer at the moment.
Yeah, but Red Bull's got a big checkbook, so don't worry about it.
Yeah, as long as people keep guzzling the energy drinks, you know, there's hope. Ditto Monster and the various other ones as well.
Yeah. Okay. So that's it from Thailand.
Yep.
Real quick, Rich, we've talked about this. Your three favorite race win celebrations, the podium of race win celebrations from any time. Give me your podium. Give me your third place on the podium, and then I'll give you mine.
Okay. I've got a couple of honorable mentions, which I'll come to at the end, but
Okay, that's
I've
fair.
thought long and hard about this, but I mean, I think we might be somewhat aligned here. But so number
Could
three
be.
on my list is here, not because it was a great one, but it was because it was a really stupid one, but that made it great. And that was Jorge Lorenzo jumping in the pond at Jerez. Don't ask me which year it was, but in
Yeah.
full leathers and a helmet at the end of a race, jumps into a lake and almost drowns, or got potentially into a bit of difficulty and realize the folly of that endeavor fairly quickly.
Yes.
So that would be my number three, perhaps. Yeah, stupid one that was quite funny. Because let's not forget, Lorenzo caught a fair bit of flack, I think, to be honest, justifiably, because he did do a bit of a copycat kind of thing. Whether it was to try and emulate in a sort of flattery sort of, I don't think it was that. I think it was to try and sort of get under Valentino Rossi's skin at the time. And, they always fell a bit flat to me, but that one was kind of, yeah, quite amusing because it was so disastrous, really.
Okay, I have one honorable mention. We'll do that later. But my third place on the podium, Valentino Rossi with the Claudia Schiffer doll,
Okay.
because of what Biaggi and him, when the rivalry that they had in 250s, I thought that was just absolutely over the top, funny and creative and fun. So that's who I have in the third place. Second place on your podium, Rich.
Claudia Schiffer, yeah.
Blake Schiffer.
No,
Okay.
I'm
Okay.
pretty sure, was Rossi in 125s or 250s when he pulled
I thought it
this
was
one off?
250. I thought it was 250s.
It could have been, because that's probably when.
Biaggi had come back from 500s and went back to 250s and was running off the four titles on the Honda is when that happened. I believe. I could be wrong.
Yeah, I seem to recall. Well, so Biaggi had the four 250 titles on the bounce, didn't he? Then went up to 500s. Almost beat Mick Doohan in the first season in 500s, as I recall, but didn't quite make it. And then just
Chilled.
never really kind of had another serious go at it, as I recall. Anyway, but with Rossi coming up, the sort of the Italian rivalry started to really kick in. And I think at the time, around this time, Biaggi was either seen dating or made a big play about the fact that he was going out with Naomi Campbell, who was obviously one of the supermodels at the time. And so hence the blow-up doll with Schiffer, or Claudia stenciled on the back. It was an absolute kind of kick in the nuts dig at Biaggi by Rossi, who knew that they were going to have some fairly sort of tasty battles to come. And they weren't even in the same category at this point, let's not forget. So
It's
this
true.
was definitely Rossi doing the whole mind game, I'm coming for you every which way trick. And it was really was a, a signal of things to come. And for that reason alone, it's on the list for me, because A, it was very, very funny, and B, it was ruthless as well. And that was what Rossi was. I mean, what was it, Michael Scott, one of my favorite MotoGP journalists, said, I think it's in the film Faster, actually, talking about Rossi, says, people should never forget what he is behind the smile. He's a ruthless assassin. And that was a great example of the way he would go about doing stuff to get at people. Brilliant.
Yep. Okay, so second place on for me was Jorge Lorenzo at Le Mans, where he got off the bike, got the chair, and sat and watched the big screen and ate popcorn. I loved that one because I thought it was of all the ones Lorenzo did, I thought that was his best one because I didn't really like the astronaut thing, but I thought that one was really cool. Hey, I'm gonna eat popcorn and I'm gonna watch a movie on the big screen. What better way to celebrate a win? So I take that at second place. So that leaves us to your position. Let's do honorable mention before we go to the top spot. So
Okay.
give me honorable mentions quick.
Honorable mention would be Rossi with the broom, which was his
Okay.
kind of retort for the Qatar thing. And so it was a bit of a dig at
Yep.
Gibbonau and the Gresini squad at the time for sort of dobbing him in on that. So that was one. And then the other one was, again, it's Rossi. I mean, these are all Rossi for me, I'm afraid, pretty much, was the ball and chain, where, again, I think it was probably 2003. Rossi had lost a few races to Gibbonau and he was getting a bit of heat from the Italian press, I think it was at the time. So, the whole ball and chain thing was them sort of holding him back, or they wanted to send him to prison. So he kind of came out with the striped suit on. It's just a real piss take, really, which
Clever.
is he was very, very good at.
So my honorable mention is Pedro Acosta pulling the pizza box out at Mugello. I thought that was pretty clever. So
Good one.
Spanish guy beats the Italians home turf. Hey, have a pizza. Yeah.
Rossi-esque.
Rossi-esque. Give me your number one position on the
My
podium.
number one, and I don't really understand what the point of it was, but it was the Rossi Portaloo incident.
That's my number one.
Yeah, I mean, it was just like a totally random thing. And was it at Mugello? I'm trying to think where it was.
I don't remember where it was, but the thing of it to me was it implied that, okay, I won the race, immediately stop, run to the portalette, pee, and come back. And the whole part of it was the only reason I went so fast was because I had to pee. That was how I took it. And I'm
Right,
like,
okay. Well, maybe that's what it was.
then I think that is the best one that's ever been done, is just absolute classic to
Yeah, it was
me.
just very, very
So.
funny at a basic level. I mean, I'm British, so anything to do with toilets is just immediately hilarious, no matter what the context is. So, yeah. I mean, the thing about Rossi is I can't really think of anybody before him that did this sort of thing. He kind of invented the concept of the crazy stunt after winning, didn't he?
Yep, the championship celebrations were his idea too. The Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, for when he had seven titles at that time. So,
Did he not do a bowling alley one as well, or was that the Seven Dwarfs? Maybe that was the same thing. I might be misremembering. There
no,
are a
no,
lot of them
there's
with
so many
him.
of them.
It's a little bit like, as I've said before, I'm a sort of dyed in the wool heavy metal music fan, and people say, the song Black Sabbath by Black Sabbath is the defining heavy metal song, and everything else is interpretation. And with
Okay.
post-race celebrations, it's like these kind of key Rossi ones define the art, and everything else is really just a copycat or an interpretation on the theme. So the only thing I will say is one thing that's starting to get a little bit tiresome to me is the whole gold leathers and gold crash helmet thing, because everybody does it, and it's like it's not really that special anymore. So I wish people would just sort of get on with their slow down lap and just go in and celebrate with their team rather than these. I mean, as much as I love Toprak Razgatlioglu, and I really, really do, that was a self-indulgence gone mad, what he did at the last round when he deservedly won the championship, but spent like 10 minutes in a pretend cardboard alien ship changing into, and we're all thinking, what's he going to come out as? Like a big bird or something. No, it was bloody gold leathers and a gold crash armor. It was, oh, really? We've just waited 10 minutes for that? It's all a bit tiresome and predictable, really. So I wish they'd come up with something a little bit different, but
Yeah.
nobody will ever really beat the Portaloo for me.
No, nobody will. Okay, that's it for this show, guys. We're back next week with the results of what happens in Malaysia. Until that time, I ask you all to ride safe.
Cheerio.